I thought in reading over the things that you've written about Turner, you've talked a lot about sort of his intellectual contributions and whatnot. I thought maybe the most useful thing would be to concentrate on his biographical life, that you sort of your relationship to him and what you can tell about his teaching, all of that. And the question I thought I might ask you first would be, even before you came to Harvard, were you aware of the Frontier Thesis, or were you aware of Turner's reputation, any of that?
No. I had two very good high school teachers of history. They knew who Albert Bushnell Howard was, and when I didn't say that I really would like to study history, they said, well, Harvard is the place you ought to go. And I don't think they knew anything about Turner. So, but I became aware of concentrating in history, and I rather soon became aware of Turner. And then I began to get very much interested in him. But I really didn't see anything of him until junior year when I took the course. But the thing that impressed me most of all, I guess, was the difference between his appearance and personality and the stereotype that we get from his books of what the Western or the frontier person was. Very outgoing, the image of the Western or frontier people. Very outgoing, inquisitive, and so on. Rather not brash, certainly without many of his races. Rough
humor.
And Turner covered that with very much the scholar and gentleman. Of course, he loved the outdoors, as we know, when he loved trout fishing with Miss Perry and others. But the difference between my conception of the Westerner as the course developed, as I began to read, and Turner's general appearance and character and personality, definitely is a very interesting, not paradox exactly, but antithesis of some kind. But I remember the first conversation I had with him was I decided that we would do a paper. And I was interested in American literature as well as history, and I thought, well, maybe I could write something on some American writer of the 19th century in the frontier. So I decided to just walk with him across the yard.
This is as an undergraduate?
As an undergraduate.
Uh-huh.
And he was very cordial in his quiet, low key way. He asked me where I came from. And he said that he had spent, as a young man, some time in Omaha himself. High school in Omaha I've been to, and it was very, it made me feel very comfortable, it made me feel very much at ease, and I didn't feel I had been an intruder, he walked across the geography. But then I approached the subject, and I said I was thinking I might write on either Emerson or Walt Whitman and their reaction to the West, and he thought that was a very good idea. I said, I think one of them would be all I could handle. Then he said, you ought to learn about both of them. So see what, read them both as much as you can. Well, the materials, of course, in those days were limited. We didn't have the letters and quite many of the things we now have. So it wasn't as gigantic a task. And he was very pleased with the paper, and I developed it and presented it in my senior honors. You go out of the term paper in junior year. So I think that in the course, his interest in the humanities didn't very much come through. It was very much a social science kind of history for those days. But in talking with him, and I remember particularly he invited me. I guess that was my first year of graduate work. I was invited to Thanksgiving dinner at his house. And he talked about the theater. He's a great admirer of the great Italian actress Eleanor Dusa. He and Mrs. Turner had seen in Europe. His reading in literature was limited, but he was very much interested in it. And he had read many of the classics, I think, as an undergraduate in the Greek and Roman classics. So, he was, I think, the one word that always seemed to me to be the key to his personality was very genuine and not assumed or put on modesty. He didn't like people in any way to flatter him. There was one graduate student from Montana who was painfully obnoxious in his constant flattery of Turner. You'd see that, but he was so much a gentleman, he didn't know quite how to calm him down. I think as a teacher, as an undergraduate teacher, what impressed me very much was that unlike Channing, who played to the galleries and who wanted to be liked in his own peculiar way, Turner seemed to be completely indifferent for his further undergraduates, like to cross him off.
Oh, really?
He didn't seem to care if after the beginning of the course students walked out. He seemed to be quite indifferent to it. He made no effort to liven up the lectures. If you weren't very much interested in the subject, you were likely to be very bored. He would come in with these, you know, big folders and many maps, slides, and it was so different from what Channing was doing, or Hart, though Hart by this time was so passe that he hardly commented. Except I did take a course from him on Lincoln and the Civil War, and I saw there that was the first time I was really conscious of that. The Turner was uninterested in the Civil War. We did almost nothing with it in the course.
He wasn't concerned
with it. And, of course, this was a course on Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War, but Hart gave it a terrible course. It's so bad that I can't tell anyone how bad it was. It's just pathetic. Really. But at least made me more aware than I guess I had been of the Civil War was just not part of our slavery.
Yes.
So he was, as we look at it now, rather old-fashioned in the way he... It was a very... For an undergraduate course on the history of the West, it was what I guess pretended to be, but it left out so much that even in a course in the West, one might have thought it would have been made more explicit.
What was left out most significantly, other than the war?
Yes. Well, he was aware of urbanization, and particularly in the development of Western cities, but he didn't do much with it. As we know, the famous letter he wrote to Schlesinger.
Mm-hmm.
Even in my junior year, I guess, 1918, he referred to the development of these cities and their relation to railroads and the competition of railroads and the areas that they were exploiting or serving. But in general, as we now think of urbanization as part of American history, it's not there.
How about Indians? Were they significantly present?
No, this is another thing. You see, this was before the days we were very much aware of modern ethnic history. The Indians were just there, and he was aware that there were tribal differences, and he was aware that there were cultural differences, linguistic differences, and traders and so forth. But I don't think he had any real conception of the Indians from the point of view of the Indians, and not as much as one might have thought. even from the point of view of the settlers and the people who came up against them. Mm-hmm. But they were there, and they had to be. They have trees, and you have to clear the land or get titles. But they were very inconsequential as actors in the drama,
mm-hmm.
which seems to be very strange for one interested in the westward movement that he didn't pay more attention to.
Especially given his own doctoral dissertation.
With the fur trade.
Yeah.
It could be that my memory is playing me false.
No, I don't think it is.
I don't think so. I heard the Indians were just there and Destiny had decided that they got out of the way.
Tell me more about the structure of the lecture course. You say he was indifferent to the students. How were
yes.
the lectures structured?
Well, he didn't. There were no anecdotes. There were no concrete dramatic illustrations which would liven it up and give it a sense of actual people. He might stop with John Brown, I remember, he did in Kansas. I remember he said that many of the movement abolitionists thought that Tuna said in his view, his mind was badly arranged. But occasionally he, would give us a little something about some personality. But he just wasn't interested. And of course, for Channing, these were important things in an undergraduate lecture course.
Mm-hmm.
There were lots of statistics. And, he'd project statistical tables on the screen and comment on them. And lots of maps that he had made, as well as the physiographic maps, and long commentaries and explanations of these figures. So if you were interested, this was good, but most undergraduates, I think, found this very boring.
So it was a small class, not that
yes,
many people
it
took
not
it?
Yes, very big. I think the year I took it, perhaps, this is a mere guess, certainly not more than 70 or something like that, which in relation to Channing's course would have been very small.
Was there a student nickname for him or a nickname for the course?
Yeah.
There wasn't anything like that?
That was true of his Wisconsin period, of course, but I never heard him referred to anything except Mr. Turner.
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Turner. He was very generous in sharing his. I remember in my first graduate year, one of my classmates and I were roommates, and he was starting in the business school, and he'd heard me talk so much about Turner. I said, before I leave Cambridge, I would like to meet this great man. So I asked Mr. Turner if I could bring my roommate who's a graduate student in business school, and he said, of course, and we went over. And to have a whole evening, and Turner just did most of the talking. We asked an occasional question. He was just extremely generous. I mean, he had no obligation to do this. I think it was not uncharacteristic of him.
Mm-hmm.
Very intellectually very generous.
Was he the teacher as an undergraduate that most influenced your interest in history, or were there other people who were equally important?
I was very much interested in history, and I had really some very good courses.
Mm-hmm.
The only one that wasn't good was this one, Albert Personal Hart, who was really in his dotage.
Mm-hmm.
It was very sad. You realized that he shouldn't be teaching. He also gave a course which I, for fun, audited in my first year of graduate work. On the history of federal theory. Did I tell you about that?
No.
I must tell you that. That's an amusing story. The League of Nations was now being born, and this would have been about 1921, I guess. And so I thought it would be interesting to see what I was interested in political theory and had taken McElwain's course and also Lasky's course.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, let's see what Mr. Hart does on that. And he would bring in huge folders with parts of books cut out, put in there. And it made no preparation, really. And it began with the Greeks and about fiddle theory among the Greeks. And they didn't know much about it. And one day he said, the next lecture done will be fiddle theory in Latin America, a very important subject, very neglected. So the next time he came, he started beginning at the top and one after the other. Got to the bottom of the pile again. Found what is it for us. He did it all over again, continuing to tell us how important the theory in Latin America was. But then he looked up over his glasses and he said, gentlemen, there is no federal theory in Latin America. the other course, so I think I was fortunate in being at Harvard when there were some really great teachers of history, particularly Ferguson in ancient history. I had 2 years with him, one Greek history and one Roman history, and I guess a semester course in Hellenistic history. A great lecture, polished, elegant, and yet provocative. Many times have an elegant lecture, but it is necessarily very stimulating. This is an aesthetic experience. But Ferguson managed to do the two things. The Canadian scholar. Now I was very much interested in European history, particularly medieval history with Haskins.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't Turner alone, but I had no question that Turner was the one I wanted to do graduate work with.
Why was that?
Well, partly because I liked what he was doing. History seemed to me to be something more than narrative and episodes and interesting conflicts and so on. And Turner's emphasis on history as process and movement of peoples and the relation with the environment appealed to me very much. It was quite different from all the other histories that I've been exposed to. But also I just liked him. His modesty and his quiet something very magnetic, even in his later years, and I'm sure he didn't have the magnetism we hear his early students talking about. Even then, there was something extremely endearing about him. You really just loved him. He was strong but sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And combined the two things. So I liked him. And Channing was a very. I had a seminar with him too. But he was all right. He had some good students.
When you say Turner was not falsely modest, that surprises me a little bit in that he was clearly a man in his letters who liked to be praised.
Oh, yes.
He loved to be praised, I think. But
except not effusively, as this guy from Montana did, and as overtly and so on. Yes, he believed in what he had done.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, he more than once in the seminar, talking about revisionism, said he knew that what he had done would be revised, and some of us might even be among the revisers. And he said, and so will your work be changed and revised. So his presidential address of age A, where he presented relativism. I've forgotten the year, but it was
1910 or so.
I think so.
Yeah.
It was before Robinson's essays on the new history came
out.
It was about the time, and of course Becker. I've forgotten, but anyway, it was Turner whose sense of relativism was virtually the only historian at Harvard who expressed this point of view.
Hmm.
In the liberal club, so I was members. We decided that we ought to have Robinson come up from Columbia and tell us about the new history. And he did. He was very interesting in his rather dry, strange way. So I had no question that Turner was the one I really wanted, that I admired most. And I think it was because this sense of history as something more than events, and as process and change and movement and lacking. We hear a lot about the myths that the legends of the frontier gave rise to. He never mythologized any of the people, and all of these people he referred to, but never in the terms that we think of as the mythological. He was very realistic, in other words.
Could you characterize the chief differences between his undergraduate teaching and his graduate seminar?
Yes. His undergraduate teaching, entirely lectures. There were no quiz sections. There were no
discussion.
You did a term paper. And he did read those papers and commented on them. If you had questions, and not many did, you felt free to ask him about it. Occasionally, I did, like a few of them. But he didn't. He was not seemed to be interested in being popular with undergraduates. In the seminar, he, as I've so often said, he really seemed to believe that we were all learning together, and he it was never a master-pupil relationship. He just had assumptions that weren't warranted. We weren't. But on the other hand, it stimulated some of us to think, well, maybe we can do better than we thought. He seems to think we can. And since he's right on a lot of things, he's right there. But he was a very friendly and informal. He raised lots of questions. We gave our reports. He was never like Channing, cynical and brutally critical. He would just ask questions until you finally saw where you were wrong. He just did it by a series of questions. It was a very good technique, I think. I think the thing that I liked most as a graduate teacher, he felt that the monograph is indispensable, and we have to work with monographs. But he wanted, in each case, he wanted us to try to relate our monograph to a much bigger historical context. Mm-hmm. And no one else, in my experience at Harvard, did that.
Oh, really?
They didn't. Here it was. You did this, and if you had the imagination to try to relate to something else, it was acceptable. But Turner made it very clear that the research we'd done was chiefly of importance, apart from the learning experience, technical experience, learning what to do with evidence and documents, was to see how that fitted into the pattern of history. Whether, I remember once he said, do you think that what you've given us here in this paper, in what way is it promoting whatever it was, in what way was it retarding? How do you relate this to change in a larger context? And this is very good, because you have to think, well, what is the meaning, what's the significance of what I've done? And I think that was a great thing. We had to do then a synthesis. So it wasn't just orally. We had to write a paper.
Oh, I see.
And which, at the end of the year, we had to write a paper in which we indicated what we thought the relationship of our research was to the period. And I think that was the first year we were working in the 1840s. And what we thought our research had done in terms of what is seemed to be known about American history at that period.
So the seminar was organized decade by decade, sort of? Worked that way?
Pretty much. And parallel, more or less, what he was writing in the world, working on himself.
And I guess what I still don't understand is what the synthetic papers were supposed to be connected to some larger sense of the processes that were going on. What processes was he most interested in having you relate your monographs
to?
Well,
a lot of it was really political history.
Oh.
I stopped to think of it. I remember working on Virginia, and I used the National Intelligence, or some of the Richmond papers which were acquired. And in that case, it really didn't have much to do with the frontier, except in a small way. But what Virginia's representatives in Congress, what they were voting for and what they were arguing for, how that related to the other sections, and how we would relate it to the nation as a whole. But it was, in a sense, it's political history. I didn't think of it at the time, but I think it really was. But the framework was the section, and the sectional concept, and how does Virginia fit in, and the different sections of Virginia. He made a great point in relation to physiography and geography. So his sectionalism was much more refined than just big
How was the course structured in terms of how did people choose their topics and how?
We have pretty much freedom. He just said this is the period. You really have to define history in terms of some time space. So he said, I'm myself working on the 1840s. And so since we are working together and teaching and learning and teaching from each other, I'll ask you to select a topic within this. And then we had a good deal of freedom to do what we wanted to do. Only with consideration for some geographical area within this time. Other than that, freedom of choice.
And there must have been an early time for the first few weeks of the course when people weren't ready to give reports. What did he do during that time? He just gave lectures?
Well, they weren't really very organized lectures, but he put a sort of informal talking to us about history and historical method as it was traditionally conceived. Then about the period that we were going to work in, how other historians had looked at this, how he thought he was regarding it, with many questions, and he raised lots of questions in those. So we felt that this is an exploratory, and that the answers aren't in. I think he tied in those early lectures to talk to. Kind of evoke a mood and a sense of what it was all about.
And did he have a definition of historical method that was clearly different from his colleagues, or was it just reading the sources and being accurate about the way you quote things?
I think he had a broader conception of historical evidence than many historians did. He thought we had lots to learn from sociology and obviously from geography and demography. So I think he felt that these census data and so forth were historical evidence equally important and perhaps even more important than certain documents that constitutional and political history was concerned with. So I think his conception of evidence was rather broader than was conventional.
Was there anyone else in the department who would have been interested in those kinds of materials, or was he really the only one?
I think he was the only one. But he knew this. Harvard still had the geography department at that time. It gave it up. And he knew those people. And he knew the economists and quite well, I think. particularly tossing with the other economists too. And Harvard had no sociology. It didn't have a sociology department until very much, much later. But he had an interest in sociology. They knew something about the French and Italian sociologists. Something about what was being done in Chicago, where he had talked there, but he was new to Chicago people. So,
when you said that he was an unusually attractive teacher for you, you knew that you wanted to have him as your advisor. Was that true of a lot of students? Did students
gravitate
to him?
I think all of us who were his graduate students, we felt very much the same. We felt very close to him. We felt that he was going to be very helpful to us, and that he was very comfortable to work with. I think his shortcoming was that he gave us too much free rein. I think I would have profited more had he. It was not that he didn't appreciate rigor and accuracy, he did, but I think he was so pleased with anything which showed any. I think his shortcoming was that he gave us too much free rein. I think I would have profited more had he. It was not that he didn't appreciate rigor and accuracy, he did, but I think he was so pleased with anything which showed any innovation or imagination that we were tempted to, at least I was tempted to do more perhaps than things beyond my ability at the time. I remember Hansen, who worked with immigration, mm-hmm. One of the kind of students, was a great admirer of this freedom which Turner gave him. There wouldn't have been probably anyone else in the history department, Channing or Parker, who was the only one. Well, Morrison would have done. I think that perhaps he might have been a little bit more, might have emphasized discipline a bit more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did I don't really know the structure of the Harvard graduate program at that point. You did 2 years of coursework, or how long were you in a seminar before you started doing your dissertation research?
Well, you had six fields. There were only two. Two of these could be American history. Then there were four others, and one was supposed to be in another department. Caroline Ware, for instance, chose anthropology. We were very much impressed that she chose anthropology as an outside. She was the only one of us who did, and it paid off, as her later work showed. So you had to choose one outside department, and I chose political science, and particularly within that political theory. Mm-hmm. Then you had to do. Then there would be three that were normally European history. You could do Latin American. They have a Latin American history. You could do that. In my day, there was no East Asian history. So it had to be either Latin American history, and obviously no African. It had to be either Latin American history or European. Mm-hmm. And it had to be the Renaissance and Reformation and English history. Mm-hmm. And Russian history. I had Russian history. So you did these courses, and you took these prelims, which covered all of your all of your fields except American history. There are four fields, and you were examined in, but not in American history. So your American history exam didn't come until you till the very end, and as a part of your examination on your dissertation.
Oh, really?
Oh. So I was remembered how uncomfortable I felt, because I was teaching at Smith College, and I had to get this degree. And Schlesinger had approved my dissertation, my thesis, and he said some picky criticisms of it. But then I remembered. There will be Merck will be on the board, and he on the committee. And he'd been my tutor. I knew him, but I know he's very demanding. And I remember he asked me a question that I just it seemed so simple you would have thought. He asked me how wheat would have got from Wisconsin exactly. How would wheat get from Wisconsin to Europe? So simple, but I was unexpected. Morrison was on the committee, and he was very nice. In spite of my pacifism, we had a friendly relationship. He didn't approve of that.
So there were 2 years of course,
yes,
3 years?
2 years.
I had just finished asking you about how long the period of coursework was, and then I was going to
I'm not sure that there was any set time for it. It seems to me that we did it in, at different times. There would be, I don't know whether the exams were given once or twice a year. And then if you felt you were ready to take them, you did, but some didn't take them, others with another year. I can't remember what I did, but it wasn't absolutely specified. Right? So, and then you did your dissertation, and then you examined on American history.
And what I wanted
part of the final examination. This was all oral. So they can ask you anything.
While you're defending your dissertation, they can ask you about anything else.
The dissertation was sort of subordinate to the. I mean, it was a part of it. They asked you how you put. To relate your dissertation to the field of American history, and then they begin.
So you had one semester seminar with Turner, or two, or
I had 2 years.
2 years all the way through. Oh, you mean these are seminars that you just are a member of, and you're there indefinitely.
And you're just there.
Oh, I see.
Well, yes.
So you would have a year to do these for monographic papers, and then do another one the next year.
Yes.
Oh, I see.
I started my first year, and then I dropped out for a year to teach at Beloit, came back, and I was in the seminar up here.
Do you remember?
Then I had what was called a 20 course, a research course at Turner. I saw him done about once a week, or certainly every other week, maybe every week, depending on how much I got done.
And that was on the dissertation?
That went on. That was on the dissertation, and that went on until you finished it.
And at what point in the seminar did you settle on a dissertation topic? And did that happen early on or late? Or
I can't quite remember. In general, I would think not immediately, rather toward the later part of it. And in my case, it really didn't grow out of any one paper that I written, but out of the idea of American self-consciousness, as Turner and I defined it in the pre-Civil War decades.
Mm-hmm. What I wanted to ask you is how he was as a dissertation advisor as opposed to a seminar.
Well, I think he was very good. He asked good questions. And I think that he, in my case, it was sort of out of his, it wasn't out of his field of interest, but it was out of his own research.
Yes.
And I read a lot of periodicals, and it was intellectual history, really. And he was very much interested, and I also had, as a kind of an advisor, in a smaller way, Miss Perry, mm-hmm. who was the only one really interested in American literature. And I had a 20 course with Miss Perry on American literature, and what I was doing in this dissertation, this thesis, was related to the kind of things I was reading with Miss Perry.
Mm-hmm.
Turner was technically my advisor, and he felt that what I had done was, he liked it, but he felt that I needed some more work, and he also quite probably said it spreads too widely. He said it's substantially, I think, a very good thing. But he said, I'm retiring, and my successor is Mr. Schlesinger, who is very much interested in the things you've written about here. So I think the best thing to do for whatever revision that you do on this, and I think there are some is needed, you should do it with him. And so I submitted my manuscript to him, and the rest of it you know. He said, this is not a dissertation. This is a series of essays on, and I told that story before.
Well, I was surprised at reading the piece that you just sent me, which I enjoyed quite a lot. I was surprised.
I've had some interesting letters about that. He's a hilarious one from Bob Nesbitt, who said, you know, the trouble with your piece people was they missed the key. They should have featured pop music. Pop music is apparently loved by all cultures and all ethnic groups and all people of the Soviet Union. There he went on, some very hilarious and funny remarks. Well, I had some very interesting letters. I was afraid afterwards that it might seem egotistical and self-serving.
No.
But then I thought, well, at my late age, there's nothing, that I would want anyway. So,
and
the editors had wanted me to do this. They thought it would be an interesting idea.
Well, I think it was. I think it was a good article. But what surprised me about it, I thought it was quite a comment on Turner's direction of your dissertation that Schlesinger would so completely turn it over.
Beer, coffee, or
I'm fine. I'm fine. But it struck me that in some ways that was a fairly strong criticism of Turner's advising of your dissertation.
It was. However, I felt very indebted to Schlesinger because he was quite right. I needed to do something much more exhaustive on some subject. So I had a few pages on the peace movement in this. And he said, you should select something and then look at it. So I asked him if the peace movement would be acceptable. He said, yes.
Was he explicitly critical of Turner? Did he say anything of Turner?
No, he just said, these are interesting essays. And later, we came to be friends. And we were both on the SSRC at the same time. And he once said, well, he said, you know, I'm very interested in what you did there. He said, I see you in one form or another, you published the law. I sent something to one periodical and another. The American Historical Review published one chapter.
Sure.
And so on. And he said, this is very, you certainly got a lot of mileage.
Were you angry at Turner at all for having put you in that situation?
No, no. Because I had learned a lot, and my only criticism was I think that he shouldn't have let me do quite exactly as what I wanted to do. I think he probably should have said that. Maybe he did say what he did suggest was very interesting. He said there is a man at the Sorbonne that I was going to go to who takes American literature more seriously than American universities do. And he said you might give your manuscript to him, and it's Charles Sest. And I followed two of his courses, and he was very pleased with this and suggested that if I translated it just as it was into French and got my French oral better, that it would be very acceptable for the Doctor of Université, the Sorbonne. But I decided, well, I started it, and I better try to finish there. And this was before Schlesinger had come onto the scene. This is in between.
Mm-hmm.
Schlesinger was quite right about it, and I didn't. I appreciated all that Turner had done for me, and I think probably in the case of these other students, they were doing more conventional subjects. Probably there's no question about it.
Are there, I wanted to ask you a couple questions about the frontier thesis, although that's not mainly, you have written a lot about that, and I don't want you to repeat, I don't want to force you to repeat yourself about that. But are there any other things about him as a teacher that you haven't had a chance to say that you'd like to share?
No,
I think you've covered most of it.
I think so.
Okay. Well then, let me, we're about at the end of this case, let me just... ask was really, of the graduate students or undergraduates who were there at Harvard while you were there, how was the frontier thesis regarded by them at that time? Was it regarded as sort of an older idea that was of an older generation?
I don't think so. Let's take Jim Hedges, who was one of my fellow graduates, mm-hmm. from whom I had great esteem. He was working on the railroads and colonization. And while that was a part of the Western history, it was also part of economic history and something that hadn't been done. And I don't remember all of the others, but they were doing things which were within the field but were things which Turner himself had not really done. So I think we have the impression this is an ongoing thing that even when Turner stops, there will be many other things in this general field that he's opened up mm-hmm. that will invite research. So I think the general feeling among us was that this was ongoing and that Turner got it underway and that others would carry on.
Well, most of the strong criticisms of Turner came out after his death, so that those wouldn't have been going then, but there was Charles Beard's.
They began to come in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And 1934?
I think,
One of the criticisms that I thought at the time, I don't think it had much general reading on it, was Lewis Hacker's criticism. Hacker was a Marxist. Mm-hmm. Later became an arch
conservative, yes.
But I think that he pointed out things which I hadn't got, which seemed to me to make some sense. But I think you're quite right. Most of them came after. But Turner used to say very often, Channing was a noted critic of his work and made it very clear. He just laughed and said, this Western movement is a small part of American history and it's going to be forgotten. And these are the things. So there was criticism. Turner was very aware of that. But he said, I expect there will be revisions. He said, I don't think it's all going to go down the drain, but I think there will of course be revisions. Mm-hmm. And that's just what scholarship is really all about. I think he took a very honest and legitimate pride in what he had done. And I don't think he was as doctrinaire as some people made him out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The earliest of the criticisms, I think, was the Beard article. Was it in the New Republic or someplace like that in 1920?
I think that did hurt Turner, because Turner and Beard knew each other, and I think that probably is hard to take.
Did that make much of a dent on the graduate students? Was that read and people feel concerned about that, or was it just something that was overlooked?
I read it, and... I guess the first period I subscribed to was the New Republic. And I've been impressed by the two books of Beard that I'd read. We didn't have the American Rise hadn't come out until 1927.
Mm-hmm.
But Beard was, I never heard Turner make any disparaging remarks about him, but Channing and other people at Harvard took a very dim view of Beard. So this carried over to graduate students to some extent, I think. And I got acquainted with Beard only after that.
So the critique was probably less strongly respected just because it came from Beard, in other words.
But I have a sense that this probably did hurt Turner.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think that's really all I wanted to ask you about, unless there are other things.
I'm sure that I've said all of this before.
No, you haven't. Some of these things, especially the teaching-related issues. Maybe I should just ask you to describe his voice. You haven't done that, really, how he sounded. Can you try to capture that?
Well, we've heard from many of his melodious voice.
Yeah.
And this is true. It was rich and very rich and full, but never harsh. There was always a gentleness in this richness that was very, very distinctive. I've never heard anyone kind of a voice. Mm-hmm. All voices are unique, of course. But it's true. It was a very, very pleasing. There was something very, very sonorous, but not like the essays, which are eloquent, vivid images, poetical. His lecturing style was not that way. Very down to earth. There's a marked difference between these poetical flourishes and these antitheses in his essays, and his down to earth, level matter type.
So there were no lectures that really had that quality of the public.
Not that I can remember.
That's fascinating.
Not that I can remember. Because he started out, as we know, in speech and elocution and debating. I think that gradually wore off. There was a reference somewhere to the retirement dinner that the graduate history club made for. I remember it very vividly. We had understood, some of us, that he'd never been as happy at Harvard as he'd been at Wisconsin. So he started, I remember, by saying, whatever I have to say, I want first to express my appreciation to Harvard for what it has done for our work, and a toast to Harvard. Maybe that had a slight rhetorical. From then on, it was just Turner we'd known best.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was a very nice occasion, very, very comfortable.
Did you see him at all after that, or was that pretty much the end of your relationship?
It was the end of my relationship. I heard from him. I had some letters. He was very nice about it. I sent him a copy of the American Peace Crusade. I think I quoted what he said.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, he was very, very pleased with it. And he was immensely helpful to me. And I don't think maybe I made this clear. In the Stuart Rice volume, the essay that I wrote, Merck was the logical person to write that essay, and he had been asked to write it. He was unwilling to do it because he had no word in the English language can describe it, reverent. His attitude toward Turner was full of reverence. I admired him, loved him. I feel quite. And I found out later that Merck had been asked to do this, and Sidney B. Fay, for some reason, was on the committee of this Rice volume. And he asked me if I would do this essay, and I said, "Well, there are others who are much more qualified. There's Mr. Merck," and I said, "My friend Jim Hedges at Clark would be very good to do it." And I mentioned some others, and to be faced, said, "Well, Mr. Merck is unwilling to do it." And so I thought, well, then maybe I should do it. So I thought, well, what have I got myself into? So I wrote to Turner and said, I feel very strange about this because there are others who are better qualified to do it, but I've agreed to do it. And so will you help me as you helped me before? So he wrote these long letters, which are in the Historical Society.
Yes.
and which I'm sure you've read. He did it for other people too, but I don't think any as long as these, with as much detail in his relation to geography.
Yeah, they're wonderful letters.
They're really wonderful letters. And these were evoked because I was doing this, or he might have done it for some other reason, before the days of taping. So then I decided there was something I wanted to really talk to him about. So I asked him if I could come down to Vermont or any of his summer place. And they were very cordial. I did go. I stayed overnight with them. And I had some specific questions I wanted to ask him. He was very helpful. So whatever value there was in this essay was the result of which he gave me on it. And I did a little bit more than that.
A little bit, yeah.
But I think he probably unconsciously felt, well, this is about it where there's many social scientists will probably read. And he probably was probably a social scientist. And I think, well, maybe I should help this student of mine and get it on the record, but I really think I work in relation to social science has been. You did that. And this movie, it was widely read at the time. I think it's forgotten now. I don't suppose anyone ever looks at it.
No, no, I think people do.
Do you think so?
Oh, yeah, it's one of the two best essays, I think. From
there are some other essays which at the time many of us thought were very good. I suppose now they're quite dated. But Merck should have done that. He didn't do it.
Because he wouldn't have done a good job, you mean? Or
he could have done a great job, of course. But he took the view that there were criticisms to be made of Turner and his work. And as a great admirer of Turner, he didn't want to. He didn't want to seem to be indifferent to them. I think this is my. This is my, because I've known him quite well, but I think this is my interpretation. He just didn't feel that he wanted to do it. Great admirer of him, and of course he took over the course and made much more of it than Turner did.
He was very popular,
very popular. Yes. It's after my day, but we all heard about him. Yeah. He was very popular. He was a very good historian. His writings don't really do him justice. Except for the thing he did in Wisconsin.
I think that's his best book.
That's his best book. And then later on, toward retirement, then he got out these books on the Oregon Treaty and these other things, and they're okay, but they were not the work that we knew. As a tutor, he was just great and a great teacher. The later books don't really do them justice. They're all right, I'm sure.
Could you give me just a quick summary of your reactions to the sort of assault criticism that was directed against Turner then in the 30s and 40s, the Pearson essays or those pieces? Did you feel that they were largely deserved or undeserved in the form of that the attack took?
I felt that there was a lot to be said for these criticisms, but that in making them, the critics hadn't realized the true greatness of Turner. That these criticisms could all be true, there could be a lot of them. And that it didn't really essentially undermine my belief as a great historian, and it was because of his conception of history as a movement. And relations of environment to human behavior and struggles. And this to me was more important than any of the specific criticisms. But of course, you couldn't dodge the fact that there was urbanism and there were all of these other things that were very important. And he was a highly selective kind of history that he was doing. I guess I'm probably. Felt that he, you know, may have pushed this a little too far. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that I resented the criticism, but I just thought that the critics somehow missed what his true greatness was.
I think I agree with that. I'm always struck by that very early, the pre-1893 essay, The Significance of History, essay, which is an extraordinary
The Historical Society should have published that instead of the Frontier, because the Frontier essay is available in many different places, but that is not.
Really, only the Billington book about the Frontier and Section.
And I said, you know, I wish you had published this, The Significance of History, because this really would be more useful and helpful for us than to other here.
Yeah.
Ridge wrote a very nice introduction to it.
I have not seen that yet.
It was very nice.
I want to see that.
It was very, very good. I don't know Mr. Ridge, but I wrote a note to him and I said, I very much touched on that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's enough. Why don't we turn the